This week on Behind the Bars, we start to explore the case of John Wayne Gacy. Often called Pogo the Clown or the Killer Clown, he was easily one of the worst serial killers in U.S. history, raping and murdering at least 33 young male victims.
And welcome back to Behind the Bars podcast. Today we're doing, I think, a favorite of both of ours.
Yes, absolutely.
We're covering John Wayne Gacy, the Killer Clown. He's, I mean, close to home for Dalton. Used to be relatively close to home for me until I moved. So, Dalton has a bunch of cool stuff of his and is.
I have dirt from his crawl space. I have a piece of the house. I have a painting of his. I've got all sorts of cool shit.
Yeah. So we're going to have a lot of fun with this one. It's a long one, and it's going to be two parts. So today we're going to cover the early life of John Wayne Gacy up until his arrest. And then next week's episode is going to be everything that occurred after his arrest. And we'll go really in depth into all of his victims next week.
Yes.
So.
If you guys kind of want a background, go check out my early episodes with Dr. Helen Morrison. She was actually his, I believe, it was a psychologist, if I remember right. Psychiatrist, psychologist.
A slice of his brain.
She has all of his brain.
Or his whole brain, yeah. Sorry.
And if I remember right, she has the rest of his organs as well.
Okay.
Yeah. Super sweet lady. Go check her out. Buy her book. Her book's fantastic. She spent her entire adult life, literally all she's done is interview serial killers. So yeah. We know a lot of stuff because of her.
Yes, absolutely.
And like we said, totally super sweet lady. Always a pleasure to talk to her. So John Wayne Gacy, he had a bunch of different aliases. We have Pogo the Clown, the Killer Clown, Johnny, Colonel, because he actually owned a KFC, and Sissy. He was born March 17th, 1942 in Chicago, Illinois. And he died May 10th, 1994, at the age of 51 in Crest Hill, Illinois.
52.
Why does it say 51 here?
I don't know, because he was born in March. He died in May. He's 52.
Okay, well, whoever made this can't. Yeah. Anyway, died at 52. So, occupations, he had, like I said, a long list. He was an ambulance service worker, so essentially EMT, paramedic. A former mortuary assistant, a former shoe company salesman, a former KFC manager, former short order cook, construction foreman, and that's what he's doing at the time of arrest, and of course, a clown. Pathology, he was a serial killer, a serial rapist, a necrophiliac, and an abductor. His MO, or calling card, was rape and torture, stabbing, and asphyxiation. He was an organized lust killer. He has 33 victims that we know of. They actually reopened his case a few years ago, and they haven't added any yet, but we're pretty certain that we didn't find them all. Span of crimes was August 1967 through December of 1978, so roughly 10 years. Criminal charges, we have one count of sodomy, 33 counts of murder, one count of sexual assault, one count of indecent liberties with a child. His sentence was obviously death. He was apprehended on December 11th, 1978, and he was executed by lethal injection at the Stateville Correctional Center in Crest Hill, which, like McKenna said, that's about 40 minutes from me. I've been there numerous times. It's kind of a shithole of a place, but, you know, he deserved it. So.
Let's just go ahead and jump into early life. This is so heavy. I don't really feel like not heavy, but like not, well, if it's heavy, but like heavy in like information wise that let's not, we don't need to do any more summary than what DB just did. So we're just going to jump
in. Probably the most well-known serial killer in history.
Without a doubt.
About him like, than almost anybody else.
Which like weird. Why? But also you'll find out why.
Yeah. Like I said, I know Helen spent over 500 hours with him. And the FBI spent time with them. State police spent time with them. I mean, there was a lot more to it than just being a murderer.
It's not like the
Son of
case.
Sam who just, you know, shoots a couple people.
Fuck the Son of Sam. I sidetrack. I now get absolutely fucking irritated every time I open up Netflix and it's like the Son of Sam's Into Darkness or whatever that documentary is. I'm like, no, fuck you. It's boring. I don't want to watch it. Stop telling me to watch it. I don't want to watch it. Netflix. It's stupid.
Yep. Show I have people at work all the time. They're like, oh, have you seen this? And I'm like, no, not no, even worth boring. My time.
He's boring. I don't care about the conspiracies. I don't care. Even if there were five Son of Sam's, it's boring.
Yeah.
Anyway, John Wayne Gacy, a not boring serial killer. Born in Chicago on March 17th, 1942, the second child and only son of John Stanley Gacy and Marion Elaine Robinson. Dad was an auto repair machinist and a World War I veteran. Mom was a homemaker, which is something we see in a lot of the serial killers we covered. I think part of it's just timeline. Yeah. Not many women worked outside of the home. They were of Polish and Danish ancestry, and the family was, as also we've seen in a lot of these, Catholic. Love the devout Catholics. His paternal grandparents had immigrated to the United States from Poland, which was then a part of Prussia. Gacy was super close to his mom and two sisters, but had a really rough relationship with his dad. Dad was an alcoholic and physically abusive to everybody in the family, but also he really picked on Gacy, on John Wayne Gacy. Gacy was very effeminate. He didn't want to do sports, didn't want to do those things. He wanted to sew. He wanted to cook. He wanted to do things with his mom and sisters. I think partly because that was, you know, John was growing up a homosexual, but I think also because that was kind of a safe space because his dad was a dick. His mom really tried to shield him from his dad, but it only resulted in, you know, accusations, his dad calling him sissy and mama's boy and saying he's probably going to grow up queer. But despite this mistreatment, Gacy, you know, still loved him and he constantly sought his father's approval. In 1949, Gacy's father was informed his son and another boy had been caught sexually fondling a young girl and his dad whipped him with a razor strap as punishment. That same year, a family friend and contractor would occasionally molest Gacy in his truck. And Gacy never told anybody about this because he was afraid that his dad would blame him. Again, more of the sissy queer comments.
So Gacy was overweight and very unathletic because of a heart condition. He was actually told to avoid all sports at school. During the fourth grade, he began to experience blackouts and he was hospitalized on occasion because of these episodes. And he was also hospitalized for a burst appendix in 1957. Not really, you know, related. Just it was in there. Gacy later estimated that between the ages of 14 and 18 that he spent almost a year in the hospital and attributed the decline of his grades to missing school. His father suspected these episodes were an effort to gain sympathy and attention and openly accused his son of faking the condition as Gacy lay in the hospital.
Because you can totally burst your appendix for attention.
Yeah, I think this was more of the heart issue.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, maybe that too. Hey, it wouldn't shock me. And although his mother, sisters, and a few close friends never doubted his illness, Gacy's medical condition was never actually diagnosed. So it is kind of strange that they kept him in the hospital for that long and he was never diagnosed. So one of Gacy's friends in high school actually recalled several instances where his father ridiculed or beat his son without provocation. So he just would go off and beat him, usually when he was drunk. On one occasion in 57, he witnessed Gacy's father emerging drunk from the family basement and began belittling and assaulting his son for no reason. Gacy's mother obviously tried to intervene and stop this because it was her son. And he simply put up his hands to defend himself. And according to the friend, Gacy never struck his father back during these altercations, which I'm finding that hard to believe, seeing what he goes on to do. But
I think it also makes sense. He never hit his father because his father's bigger than him and he's weaker than his father, which was why as an adult, he went and preyed on people that were weaker than him because finally he had the upper hand.
Yeah.
You know?
So after high school, when Gacy became 18, he became involved in different politics, working as an assistant for a precinct captain for a Democratic Party candidate in the local neighborhood. This obviously led to more criticism from his father, who accused his son of being a patsy. Gacy later speculated that it was to seek acceptance from others because he never received it from his father. So, understandable. So, same year that Gacy's political involvement began, his father bought him a car. He kept the title in his own name until Gacy finished paying it off. This obviously took several years to complete paying it off, and his father would confiscate the keys to the vehicle if Gacy didn't do what he told him to do. In 1962, Gacy purchased an extra set of keys after his father confiscated the original set. In response, his father removed the distributor cap, keeping the component for 3 days. And Gacy recalled that he felt totally sick and drained after this incident, which I feel is a little overkill.
It really does. It like sleazy on his part, sleazy on his dad's part, but I don't understand feeling like totally sick and drained. When I first like was reading through all this information, I like kind of skimmed and saw the totally sick and drained. I was like, oh fuck, what did his dad do? Did he you know, sell it? Did he just get rid of the car that Gacy been paying him for? No.
Just took the cap away.
He took the distributor cap so it wouldn't run. It's okay, man. Like he'll give it back.
Yeah.
Anyway, hours after his father replaced said distributor cap, Gacy left home and drove to Vegas. He worked with an ambulance service, and then he was transferred to work as an attendant at Palm Mortuary. And as a mortuary attendant, he slept on a cot behind the embalming rooms. He worked there for about 3 months, observing morticians embalming dead bodies, and later confessed that one evening while alone, he clambered into the coffin of a deceased teenage male, embracing and caressing the body before experiencing a sense of shock. This prompted him to call his mother and ask whether his father would allow him to return home. And of course, his dad agreed, and he drove back to Chicago that same day. Upon returning home, he enrolled at Northwestern Business College, despite having failed to graduate from high school. So, like, good try, but you're not going to get into college that way. But he did. I don't understand how. And he graduated in 1963. Well, I mean,
this was in 1960. Like,
how do you get into college without graduating high school? That makes okay.
Back no then, sense. You probably could.
He's a white man. He can do whatever he wants.
Hey, now I had to graduate high school to get into college.
Anyway, so he graduated in 1963 and took a management trainee position with the Nunn-Bush Shoe Company. And in 1964, they transferred him to Springfield to work as a salesman and eventually promoted him to manager of his department. In March of that year, he becomes engaged to Marlon Myers.
Marilyn.
There's a vowel missing.
Yeah.
M-A-R-L-Y-N-N. That's Marlon.
How they used to spell it.
That is Marlon Myers.
That's Marilyn. That's how they used Marlon. To spell it.
No, that's Marlon. Like Nemo's dad. Anyway. Marlon Myers. And during this courtship, Gacy joins the local Jaycees and worked insanely for them. And he was named key man in April 1964. That same year, he had his second homosexual experience after one of his colleagues in Springfield Jaycees plied him with drinks and invited him to spend the evening on the sofa. He agreed. The colleague performed oral sex on him while he was drunk. By 1965, Gacy had become vice president of the Springfield Jaycees. And then that same year, he was named the third most outstanding Jaycee in the state of Illinois. I'm saying all this. I didn't look up what the Jaycees are.
Give me a second. I will tell you.
Can you tell me what the Jaycees are? Because he rose to a very prolific position and I neglected to look this up, even though I'm reading this segment.
Oh, it's the United States Junior Chamber. So it's a political
organization. Sense. Oh, JC, as in the letters JC. Okay.
No, it's actually J-A-Y-C. Yeah.
Okay, sure. Right up there with Marlon. I love the spelling here. This is great. Let's
the wonderful 60s.
Fuck.
Yeah. So after this, he actually moved to Iowa. After he'd been married for 6 months, they moved to Waterloo, Iowa in September of 1964 after Marilyn's father actually bought three KFC restaurants in Waterloo. The couple moved there so he could manage the restaurants with the understanding they would move into his wife's former home. And it's actually been, it was vacated for him. So it's perfect. The offer was lucrative and Gacy would receive $15,000 a year. And that's the equivalent of $124,000 in present time. That is a shit ton of money for managing a KFC.
Six figures managing a singular KFC. My guy, we're in the wrong business.
I know.
What are we doing in healthcare? Yeah. This is stupid.
Plus, he'd receive a share of the restaurant's profits. So realistically, he was probably making between $150,000 and $200,000 for That's managing insane. KFC. I'll go cook go chicken for that money. Yeah. Sure makes more than I do.
Right.
So obviously he had to complete a management course, which he did. Gacy relocated to Waterloo with his wife. He opened a quote unquote club in his basement where his employees could drink alcohol and play pool, which I'm just going to guess they were probably young males. Although Gacy employed teenagers of both sexes, he only socialized with the young men. Big shocker. He gave many of them alcohol before he made sexual advances, and if they told him no, he would claim the advances were simply jokes or a test of morals. Yeah. So...
For sure.
Yeah. So he knocked up his wife, and they gave birth to a son in February of 66 and a daughter in March of 67. Gacy later described this period of his life as perfect. He'd finally earned his father's approval. When Gacy's parents visited in July of 66, his father privately apologized for the physical and emotional abuse he had inflicted throughout his son's childhood and was quoted saying, "Son, I was wrong about you." And he shook Gacy's hand. So this is kind of where they...
But also doesn't undo anything that you did.
Yeah, and we know, you know.
We know what's coming.
Yeah. Yeah, a handshake and a sorry. It's just probably not good enough.
It's too far gone. So while in Waterloo, Gacy joined that local JC chapter, Junior Chamber. And he regularly offered extended hours to the organization in addition to the 12 and 14 hour days he worked managing. Oh, he managed three KFCs.
For that still doesn't money, justify. I'll do it.
Still doesn't justify $150,000 a year. I'm sorry, that's insane. At meetings, he provided fried chicken, fucking obviously, and insisted on being called Colonel. Okay, he was ambitious and something of a braggart. No shit. But the other JCs held him in high regard, and in 67, they named him outstanding vice president. That same year, he served on the board of directors, and then Gacy and other Waterloo JCs were deeply involved in, ready for it, wife swapping, prostitution, pornography, and drug use.
It sounds like our Saturday night. Come on.
So the Gacy home was like a hot spot. They threw swinger parties. Like, he would invite all his friends over. Like, his house was the place to be, which I think was the other reason why he was in such high standing, because like all these people were getting to fuck all the time and they were getting to do it at his house. So like, we definitely want to keep him around because he's letting us do fun things.
I mean, free hookers and blow. How much better does it get?
I don't think it was, well, I guess prostitution, but I mean, it was just other wives.
Yeah. Like, I mean, prostitution, they had to be hiring
George's
hookers.
Wife, Barbara, down the street. Like, I mean, it wasn't anything fantastic. Although I don't know, maybe Barbara,
Barbara was good looking.
I couldn't tell you. So now we get to the first assault. So in 1967, Gacy sexually assaulted a 15-year-old named Donald Voorhees. He was the son of a fellow JC, which when I read this kind of gave me flashbacks to the Kansas City Butcher, where his first victim was the son of a friend or a coworker.
Son of an employer, yeah.
Yeah. So Gacy lured Voorhees to his house with the promise of showing him porn. That was regularly played, and he gave him alcohol, and this kid's 15. He's like, hell yeah, free alcohol. I'm watching porn with a full grown man, but whatever.
Yeah. It's a little creepy. Like, and just then, looking at him, it's like, yeah, I'd want to watch porn with you.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. No. But then Gacy persuaded him to engage in mutual oral sex, adding, you have to have sex with a man before you start having sex with women, which is not the case. You don't have to do that.
Clearly, I missed that class in school.
Over the following months, Gacy similarly abused several other youths, including one whom Gacy encouraged to have sex with his own wife before blackmailing him into performing oral sex on him. He tricked several teenagers, believing he was commissioned to conduct homosexual experiments in the interest of scientific research, and paid them up to $50 each. Another thing about Voorhees, when he dropped him off at home, in addition to the $50, told Voorhees that he had ties to the mob, and that if Voorhees told anybody, he would have the mob come and kill him and his entire family. So, which
maybe it's just me on this one. His wife definitely should have been charged with something too, because
yeah, I don't understand why she was totally never doing it. She's never brought in with any of this because she had sex with underage kids.
Yeah.
She's like, I don't care pedophile. Who was, like, quote, in control of the situation. You can remove yourself from that situation and call the police.
Yeah. But oh, no.
No.
Hookers and blow are too good.
No, she waits until after he gets arrested for it. Yeah, so I think she was just mad he got caught.
Yeah.
So in
March of 1968, Voorhees reported to his father that Gacy had sexually assaulted him. Voorhees Sr. immediately informed the police, who arrested Gacy and charged him with performing oral sodomy on Voorhees and the attempted assault of 16-year-old Edward Lynch. Obviously, Gacy denied these charges and demanded to take a polygraph test, and these results indicated Gacy was nervous when he denied any wrongdoing in relation to both men, which means he did it.
He did it. He failed the polygraph that he demanded.
Yeah. So Gacy obviously publicly denied any wrongdoing and insisted the charges against him were politically motivated. Voorhees Sr. had opposed Gacy's nomination for the president of the Iowa Jaycees, and several fellow Jaycees found Gacy's story credible and rallied for his support. However, on May 10th, 1968, Gacy was finally indicted on the sodomy charges. So the fact that it took 2 months for it to actually go through was a little insane.
It just shows all the like,
especially after especially after a failed polygraph test. It should have been done at that point.
Yeah, but he was high up in politics, and I think with all those strings and like the lawyers that he had, that we'll talk about a little bit more later, like he had enough on his side to try and draw shit out.
Yes. So they actually have a little excerpt of a part of Gacy's psych eval in 1968, and it says the most striking aspect of the test results is that the patient's total denial of responsibility for everything that's happened to him. He can produce an alibi for everything. He presents himself as a victim of circumstances and blames other people who are out to get him. The patient attempts to assure a sympathetic response by depicting himself at the mercy of a hostile environment. So, pretty much playing the poor me card again.
Right.
He was really good at that. So
on August 30th, 68, Gacy persuaded one of his employees, 18-year-old Russell Schroeder, to physically assault Voorhees in an effort to discourage the boy from testifying. Which is like a great way to look like you're not guilty.
Yeah.
Gacy promised to pay Schroeder $300. Schroeder agreed, lured Voorhees into an isolated country park.
That country park.
That country park Iowa. With Marlin. Fuck. To an isolated country park, sprayed mace in his eyes, and then beat him. Didn't kill him. Voorhees escaped, reported the assault to the police, identifying Schroeder as his attacker. They arrested him the next day. Obviously, he wound up confessing to assaulting Voorhees, indicating he had done so at Gacy's request. Police arrested Gacy, laid an additional charge of hiring Schroeder to assault and intimidate Voorhees. So, like, he obviously made bail, gotten out while awaiting trial for, the assault and sodomy of Voorhees.
Which at this point, you would think, you know, obviously, yes, he clearly did this if he paid this kid to beat him up, but no,
right? No, let's keep going. There has to be more. So on 12, he underwent the psyche eval that DB read you a part of at the psychiatric hospital in the University of Iowa. Two doctors examined him over 17 days, concluded he has antisocial personality disorder, which is the clinical term for like sociopathy or psychopathy, unlikely to benefit from any therapy or medical treatment, and that his behavior pattern was likely to bring him into repeated conflict with society. He's mentally competent to stand trial. However, he's going to be a problem later on. But what have we run into time and time again with the serial killers that are arrested before they're serial killers? Is that they let them go, even though everything says that they shouldn't. So
we never learn.
Apparently fucking not.
Yeah. So on November 7th, 1968, Gacy pled guilty to one count of sodomy in relation to Voorhees, but not guilty to the other charges. Gacy claimed Voorhees had offered himself to him, and he acted out of curiosity. His story was not believed, and he was convicted of sodomy on December 3rd and sentenced to 10 years imprisonment to be served at the Anamosa State Penitentiary in Iowa. The same exact day he was sentenced, his wife petitioned for divorce, obviously, and requested that she be awarded the couple's home, property, and sole custody of their two children, plus alimony. Obviously,
no, the court because was... she's a pedophile too. Fuck her.
Yep. But the court ruled in favor of her, and the divorce was finalized the following year on September 18th. And Gacy never saw his first wife or children again, which is interesting. I know one of his sons lives in Iowa, but no one can find him. I don't know where his daughter ever ended up.
Which, I mean, good. I'm glad for them. Like, I know, like, Gacy's sister is kind of in the public eye, but I don't feel like his kids should have to be.
No. His, you know. Even his sister, it took a long time for her to finally admit who she was.
I can imagine.
Yeah.
Like, you wouldn't want to be walking around being like, I'm John Wayne Gacy's sister. Great. Yeah.
She's a total sweetheart, though.
Yeah.
Yeah. So during his incarceration at the Anamosa State Penitentiary, Gacy rapidly acquired a reputation as a model prisoner. Within months of his arrival, he'd risen to position of head cook, which, no shocker, he took care of three KFCs.
He knows all those KFC secret seasonings.
Yep. It's 11 herbs and spices. He also joined the inmate JC chapter and increased its membership from 50 to 650 men in less than 18 months, which is impressive.
Yeah.
He's also known to have secured an increase in the inmates' daily pay in the prison mess hall and to have supervised several projects to improve conditions for inmates in the prison. And he actually oversaw the installation of a miniature golf course in the prison rec yard. I have never seen a prison with a mini golf course. And if there is, I might go to prison because I fucking love miniature golf.
You can do mini golf whenever you want. You don't have to go to jail for it.
But it's free there.
Is it though?
Debatable. Fine. So in June of 69, he was obviously denied parole and he began to prepare for a second scheduled parole meeting in May of 1970. Gacy completed 16 high school courses for which he got his diploma in 69, which is really weird because
didn't he graduate from college?
Yeah, he was in college before this. How the fuck did he go backwards?
Confused.
Yeah. And then on Christmas Day in 1969, Gacy's father died from cirrhosis of the liver, which obviously comes from drinking way too much. When told the news, Gacy collapsed to the floor sobbing, and his request for supervised compassionate leave to attend the funeral was denied, which I totally support denying that.
Yeah, absolutely. But even though he was sentenced to 10 years, he was granted parole with 10 months probation on June 18th, 1970, after only having served 18 months.
Which I'm curious, if they would have kept him in prison for the full 10 years, he wouldn't be able to commit some of these crimes.
No. And like,
he'd be locked up until what, 78, give or take?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And like, not that, you know, prisons do actually reform people, but like, I don't know.
Maybe. People like him, though, he has a history. He's not going to get better.
He's a psychopath. Yeah. But
and you cannot still change it. I mean, you can do all the therapy you want on him. You're not going to fix him.
Yeah. I don't know. But maybe the world would have been a different place. And I don't know. Who knows? Who knows?
It wasn't enough miniature golf. That was his problem. That's why he did this. Fuck.
He just needed to go back and for more miniature golf.
Bastard.
So conditions of his probation included that he relocate to Chicago to live with his mother and observe a 10 p.m. curfew. Upon his release, his friend and fellow JC Clarence Lane picked him up from prison. And Clarence had remained steadfast on Gacy's innocence, that he would never go back to jail. He intended to reestablish himself in Waterloo. However, within 24 hours of his release, Gacy relocated to Chicago. Arrived there on June 19th, obtained a job as a short order cook in a restaurant. And then, what day was that? June 19th of 70. So February 12th of 71, not even a year later, he's charged with sexually assaulting a teenage boy who claimed that he had lured him into his car at a Greyhound bus terminal, driven him to his home where he attempted to force the boy into sex. The court wound up dismissing the complaint when the boy failed to appear. Probably because he was dead. Just going to throw that out there. Like, he's probably dead. That boy, Gacy was into cruising, and I like pulled up at the Greyhound bus, and the kid thought that it was just going to be a normal cruise. And so got into the car with cruising, meaning guys having like one night stands and having sex with each other, probably thought it was a normal cruise, got in the car, and then I think probably got killed.
Probably.
On June 22nd, he was arrested and charged with aggravated sexual battery and reckless conduct. The arrest was in response to a complaint filed by a youth who claimed that Gacy had flashed a sheriff's badge, lured him into his car, and forced him to perform oral sex. Charges were dropped after the complainant attempted to blackmail Gacy.
So once again, could have had him back in prison.
Could have.
But we can't just behave.
And then the Iowa Board of Parole did not learn of these incidents. I'm sorry, how? Why is nobody talking to each other?
Well, it's because it was the 1970s and we didn't have internet and shit, so.
But still, we should know that he's on parole from Iowa.
I know. But anyway, unfortunately, we didn't.
They didn't learn about any of these. 8 months later, in October of 71, his parole ended. And then the following months, records of Gacy's previous criminal convictions were sealed.
Which was probably the biggest mistake of fucking this whole story.
Again, nobody is able to follow up on his actual criminal history and look at his trends and see what's happening.
Yeah. So this is where, this is where he ended up moving to 8213 West Summerdale Avenue, which is actually where he ended up murdering and burying all these people. Which, fun fact, the address of that location is no longer 8213. They changed the address because people kept stealing the address block and stuff off the curb.
Excellent. But
with financial assistance from his mother, he bought a ranch house near the village of Norridge in Norwood Park Township, which is an unincorporated area of Cook County. The address, 8213 West Summerdale Avenue, is where he resided until his arrest in December of 78, and where, according to Gacy, he committed all his murders, which I don't believe he committed them all there, because he's him.
I think he was buried a lot there.
Yeah. He was super active in the local community. His neighbors always considered him helpful. He willingly loaned his construction tools, plowed snow for neighbors free of charge. And between 1974 and 1978, he hosted annual summer parties attended by up to 400 people, including politicians. That's pretty impressive. They only knew what he did before that.
Well, because also, like, this is a small little tiny ranch house in a suburb of Chicago. Like, where are you hosting 400 people? Clearly not at his home, but, like, good God.
And I know he actually used to hang out. He met First Lady Rosalynn Carter a couple of years after this.
That's crazy.
Yeah. So it's crazy that, you know, we have this horrible serial killer and he was able to get close enough to hang out with her.
He was able to get close to everybody, though. Like, that's the thing, is he was like so in deep with like all these politicians, like. Well, it either says something about politicians. Yeah.
They all murder. They all probably like young children. I mean, they're right, politicians.
Exactly. Like, I think it's just that they're Epstein all didn't kind
kill
of
himself. You know, all the normal stuff.
No. No, he didn't.
Yeah.
The cameras just accidentally turned off.
Yeah. Hillary Weird. Clinton ate him.
I saw that the other day. And I was like,
she's a lizard person. She ate him.
Fuck. Anyway, August of 1971, Gacy became engaged to a woman named Carol Hoff. She has two young daughters. They're married on July 1st, 1972. Fiance and stepdaughters moved into his home soon after they announced the engagement, and then Gacy's mother moved out of the house shortly before the wedding. In 1975, Gacy came out to his wife as bisexual. After the couple had sex on Mother's Day that year, he informed her this would be the last time they would ever have sex. He began spending evenings away from home, only to return in the early hours of the morning, saying he'd been working late. But his wife observed Gacy bringing teenage boys into his garage and found gay porn, as well as men's wallets and IDs inside the house. And when she confronted him, he informed her angrily that it was none of her business. So, following a heated argument about her failing to balance the checkbook correctly in October of 1975, Carol asked him for a divorce, and he agreed by mutual consent. She continued to live in the home until February of 1976, when she and her daughters moved into their own apartment. And 1 month later, on March 2nd, the Gacy's divorce, decreed upon the false grounds of Gacy's infidelity with women, was finalized. So they lied to the court, saying that he was having sex with other women when in reality he was having sex with other men. Which, I mean, who cares who you're having
illegal,
sex with?
Illegal men. That's the...
Well, that is the problem. Yeah, yeah, it was more the pedophilia than it was the homosexuality.
Yeah. So in 1971, Gacy established a part-time construction business, PDM Contractors. I actually have an original business card from PDM. Yeah.
Damn.
That was not cheap. It was almost $500. Worth it. And PDM stood for painting, decorating, and maintenance. With the approval of his probation officer, which is strange because he was no longer on parole or on probation. So I'm not sure why he needed it. But with the approval, he worked weekends on his construction contracts while working as a cook during the day.
No, we're kind of jumping around. His parole ended in October of 1971.
Okay,
so he have established PDM slightly sometime before October.
Yeah, I saw 76 above and was like,
what? Right. No, I thought we were moving chronologically as well, but no, we've jumped back to 71, which is fine.
So Gacy initially undertook minor repair work such as sign writing, pouring concrete, redecorating, but he later expanded to do interior design, remodeling, installation, assembly, and landscaping. So he did quite a bit. In mid-1973, Gacy quit his job as a cook so he could commit fully to his construction business. In 1975, it was expanding rapidly, and Gacy was working up to 16 hours a day. I can relate. In March of 77, he became a supervisor for PE Systems, which was a firm that specialized in remodeling drugstores. Between PE Systems and PDM, he was working on up to four projects at a time and frequently traveled to other states. By 78, PDM's annual revenue was over $200,000, which...
which is, like, okay money, but you were making $150 managing KFCs, so, like...
Yeah.
Better, worse. I mean, so, I shouldn't talk shit. He's making more money than I am.
Yeah, he's making more than I am, too. So, through his membership at a local moose club, Gacy became aware of a Jolly Joker Clown Club, whose members regularly performed at fundraising events, parades, and voluntarily entertained hospitalized children. In late 1975, Gacy joined and created his own clown characters, Pogo the Clown and Patches the Clown. He described Pogo as a happy clown, whereas Patches was a more serious character.
Except they were both fucking horrifying.
Yeah.
Like not just in like clowns are creepy, because like I've performed as a clown. I have a lot of friends that perform as clowns. You don't have to be a creepy clown. There are really cute, fun clowns. But the way that Pogo's face paint is, it's so pointy and just wrong. It's just wrong.
Yeah, that it, and like, combined with this, like, his slightly overweight face and structure. I mean, it's just
right.
Don't
make. And also, like, his just general creepy pedophilic serial killer vibes. I really think, like, vibes really show through in a clown. Yeah, you know.
I mean, don't, like, be wrong. I love being that killer clown that terrorizes everyone, because I should go back. I mean, do haunted housework. So
yeah, I mean, I was a suspension clown. I was a suspension clown. I totally get you. I love being the creepy clown, but also, like, people still. Sorry.
All I see is a giant cat.
Sorry. But even with being, like, a performer clown, people still look at you as a performer clown and not as, like, Pogo or Patches. That was just an unsettling figure.
Yeah. So he seldom earned money for these performances, and later said that acting as a clown allowed him to regress into childhood, which, that's throwing up all sorts of red flags again. But
yeah,
they never do catch the red flags. He performed both as Pogo and Patches at numerous local parties, political functions, charitable events, and children's hospitals. Sometimes Gacy would remain in the clown garb after a performance and briefly drink at the local bar before returning home. I just imagine going into this, like, creepy, dank bar and him just sitting in the corner, just, like, slumped over.
Fuck.
And Gacy's voluntary public service as a clown throughout the years of his murders led him to be known as the Killer Clown. And
he actually did horrible things for the clown business. Like, a lot of legitimate clown performers during this time period stopped being able to get work because I feel like this is when clown fears became a thing.
Yeah.
And now it's just been passed down to us from those before us, because, like, think of, like, your grandparents. I'm sure they had, like, a clown figurine or a clown toy in their house.
Yeah,
like mine always, did.
Yeah.
There's always clown stuff. But then it's our parents. I'm, as an old human, sorry to any younger listeners, I don't know. It's our parents that I think really started the clown fear, and it was because of Gacy. And that's why so many of us are instilled with this fear of clowns growing up, because our parents are like, no, fuck that. That's Pogo shit.
Yep. My dad he just turned 54 and he is terrified of clowns to this day.
Right, because he's in the perfect time period for when this was happening.
Yep, like, that man will go toe-to-toe with anyone, but a clown, he'd be like, no, fuck this, I'm out.
Nope, fuck it, nope. Yeah.
Oh, you're going to die? That sucks. Have fun. Yeah.
So, yeah. PDM's workforce consisted, you're going to be shocked, with a lot of high school students and young men.
No.
I know. And, of course, he would proposition his workers for sex, or insist on sexual favors in return for acts such as lending his vehicles, financial assistance, or promotions. Sorry. He also claimed to own guns, once telling an employee, do you know how easy it would be to get one of my guns and kill you? And how easy it would be to get rid of the body? I'm sorry. I don't care how desperate I am for work. The second one of my employers says that shit to me, I'm out.
I'm just going to start sending you cryptic letters.
Please don't.
You should open us to be a giant clown face.
In 73, Gacy and a teenage employee traveled to Florida to view a property that Gacy had purchased. On that night in Florida, Gacy raped him in their hotel room. After returning to Florida, he drove to Gacy's house and beat him in his yard. And Gacy told his wife he had been attacked for refusing to pay him for poor quality work. So
maybe he should have just killed him.
Should have. Wait. The guy should have killed Gacy?
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
I'm not saying Gacy should have just murdered the
sorry,
fucking...
Sorry, that's what I thought. I was like, wait, which he? There's too many he pronouns happening
here.
That
got dark
on.
Real fast.
It did. I was like, shit, okay. I mean, yeah, it would have avoided the beating, I guess. In May of 1975, Gacy hired 15-year-old Anthony Antonucci. In July of 1975, Gacy went to Antonucci's home. They drank a bottle of wine, watched porn, and then Gacy wrestled Antonucci to the floor and cuffed his hands behind his back. When Gacy returned, one cuff was loose and Antonucci freed his arm while Gacy was out of the room. When Gacy returned, Antonucci, who was a high school wrestler, pounced on him. wrestled Gacy to the floor, got possession of the handcuff key, cuffed Gacy's hands behind his back, which is amazing. At first, Gacy, of course, threatened Antonucci and then calmed down and promised to leave if he would remove the handcuffs. Antonucci agreed and Gacy left. He later recalled that Gacy told him, "Not only are you the only one who got out of the cuffs, you got them on me."
And if I remember right, I'm fairly certain that kid actually wrote a book.
Oh, did he?
But a single copy of it's going to run you over $1,000 now because there were very few of them done. I believe it was him anyway.
Hold on, I'm looking it up. If I could spell.
Yeah, look up like a Gacy victim book or something of that sort. And I thought it was him.
Oh, no, not boom book. I can type.
I apologize for my sniffles. It is, well, I live in Illinois. That's all we need.
Right, it's allergy season.
Yeah, everywhere. It's miserable. It should be like a black book.
I'm not even finding a cover.
You know what? It might have been. As soon as I see it, I'll know it. Of course, now I can't find it.
The Last Victim by Jason Moss.
It might.
Buried Dreams by Tim Cahill. Hold on, I don't know. Don't have all the victim names memorized. Because there's a fucking thousand of them.
It's not the Last Victim.
My cat's going to yell about it. Is it Jason Moss? No, that's The Last Victim.
I'll have to find it. It's yeah. Not that one.
You're gonna have to cut out all of us just like silently searching.
Nah, fuck it. I'll leave it. You're Mr. Gacy's one of them.
Oh, by a victim.
Or no, that one isn't it. Dear Mr. Gacy is an expensive fucking one though.
I'm sure.
Yeah, I'll have to find it. Because now I can't fucking remember instead of driving me nuts.
Okay, moving on. July 26, 1976, Gacy picked up 18-year-old David Cram as he hitchhiked on Elston Avenue. Gacy offered him a job with PDM and he began work the same evening. On August 21st, Cram moved into his house. The next day, he and Gacy had several drinks to celebrate his 19th birthday with Gacy dressed as Pogo, which is not creepy.
No, not at all.
Gacy conned Cram into donning handcuffs, his wrist cuffed in front of his body rather than behind. Gacy swung Cram around while holding the chain linking the cuffs, then said he intended to rape him. And I read I listened to a documentary spiel that said that it wasn't saying he intended to rape him, it was like creepily singing it, like sing-songy, like giddy pogo voice, like I'm gonna rape you, like fucking horrifying.
Why does that not surprise me?
Right. So Cram kicked Gacy in the face, freed himself from the handcuffs because apparently, like, Gacy sucks at putting handcuffs on people. Yeah. He hasn't learned this yet. A month later, Gacy appeared at Cram's bedroom door intending to rape him, saying, "Dave, you really don't know who I am. Maybe it would be good if you gave me what I want." Cram obviously resisted, straddling Gacy, who left the bedroom, stating, "You ain't no fun." Cram moved out on October 5th. So I'm sorry, he didn't move out after the first incident. No. That was, what did I say, August?
August. So we're looking at September 21st. So he waited another like 2 weeks after that.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, if somebody put me in handcuffs, I'd be out.
And sing-songy telling me he's trying to rape me? No.
Yeah.
So he moved out, but he still did work for Gacy over the next 2 years.
Which I don't know why.
How desperate this man has to be for work, which yeah. I'm so sad that he's in the situation that he was in, that he felt that desperate, but my God. So shortly after Cram moved out of Gacy's house, another employee, 18-year-old Michael Rossi, moved in.
Hey, at least this one was 18.
Rossi had worked for PDM since May of 76, and he lived with Gacy until April of 77. Rossi sometimes assisted Gacy in clowning at grand openings of businesses, Gacy as Pogo and Rossi as Patches. So, again, not frowning down on people who are clowns, and I think maybe Rossi was just in it for the good feels of making kids smile and being a clown.
Believe it or not, he's actually a suspected accomplice of Gacy in the murders.
That was going to be my next thing, was I also feel like he might be also equally as fucking nuts.
He's alive still. The other accomplice killed himself, but Rossi's still alive. Mm. I tracked him down.
Of course you did.
Yeah, if that's what I think. Anyway, Gacy entered the local Democratic Democratic Party politics, initially offering use of his employees to clean up party headquarters at no charge. He was rewarded for his community service with the appointment to serve on the Norwood Park Township Street Lighting Committee and subsequently earning the title of the precinct captain. In 1975, Gacy was appointed director of the Chicago Annual's Polish Constitution Day Parade, where he supervised the event from 1975 to 1978. And through his work with the parade, Gacy met and was photographed with First Lady Rosalynn Carter in May of 1978. And Gacy, if you actually find this picture, Gacy is wearing an S-pin indicating this person was given special clearance. And this obviously was a huge embarrassment for the United States Secret Service, which even if records are sealed, if you're getting that in depth, it should have flagged something.
Well, right. That, yeah. But also... here we go. Even if they did flag him, she's not his type. No, and I don't mean that in a bad way.
You
but
have
like,
a point.
He is a homosexual pedophile.
Yeah.
Like, he's not gonna do anything to First Lady Rosalynn Carter. That's not his MO.
Yeah.
So, like, whoever they were being lazy and should have fucking found something on this guy, maybe they were also like, yeah, but he rapes young boys. Like, he's not
hurt. But let's let him be in charge of parades. That sounds like a great idea.
Definitely do that. All right. You go.
I got nothing.
You do this next part or next couple parts.
So Gacy murdered at least 33 young men and boys and buried 26 of them in the crawl space of his house. Gacy usually lured a lone victim into his house, although there's more than one occasion where, Gacy had what he called doubles, two victims in the same evening. Usually not at the same time, but, you know, one wasn't enough, so he'd go out and find another. Usually he would lure younger boys in, promising them a job with PDM, and others he'd offer a drink, drugs, or money for sex. His victims included people he knew and random individuals lured from the Chicago Greyhound bus station, Bughouse Square, or simply off the street. So he was kind of all over. Some victims were grabbed by force and others conned into believing that Gacy, because he would carry a sheriff's badge, was a policeman. Inside Gacy's house, his usual modus operandi, so calling card, was to ply youth with drinks, drugs, and gain their trust. Gacy would then produce a pair of handcuffs to show a magic trick. Sometimes he would claim this was part of his clowning routine. He typically cuffed his own hands behind his back, then surreptitiously released himself with the keys, which he hid between his fingers. He then offered to show the victims on how to release themselves, just like he did. Once he would handcuff his victims, they'd obviously be unable to free themselves, and then he would make the statement, the trick is, you have to have the key, and he would dangle the key in front of them. He referred to this act of restraining his victims as the handcuff trick. So, definitely creepy.
But again, he was so bad at putting handcuffs on.
He really was. Like, handcuffs are not a hard thing at all.
They're not. So I find it so funny that he struggled with them. But anyway. After having restrained his victim, Gacy would rape and torture them. He would frequently begin by sitting on the victim's chest before forcing the victim to fellate him. Also, quick thing, if that ever happens, fucking bite it. like how you're showing off handcuffs and I'm talking about biting a stupid fucking dick. Bite it. Anyone forces it into your mouth, bite it hard. Bite it off.
These are special handcuffs.
There was a great article about a woman who bit off her rapist dick, and it was the greatest thing I've ever
read. Well, you know, don't have non-consensual sex, and that won't happen.
Exactly, and then you won't get your dick bitten off.
Don't
anyway.
Stick it where it doesn't belong. I don't get why this is a hard concept for some people.
I tell you. But anyway, he would inflict acts of torture, including burning them with cigars, making his captive imitate a horse as he sat on their back and pulled upon makeshift reins around their necks. Mind
which
you,
he was a pretty big fucking guy. I mean, I'm a big guy and I don't know if I could hold him up.
No, he's a big dude.
I wonder if his clown had a cowboy hat at that time.
Oh, I'm sure he did. I almost guarantee you Pogo had a cowboy hat. He would also violate them with foreign objects such as dildos and prescription bottles after he had sodomized his captive. To immobilize his captive's legs before engaging in acts of torture, he would manacle their ankles to a 2x4 with handcuffs attached to each end. So basically like a makeshift spreader bar. And this was inspired by the Houston mass murders. He's also known to have verbally taunted many of his victims throughout their continued abuse and to have dragged or forced sexual victims. Fuck. Nope. Start again. He's also known to have verbally taunted many of his victims throughout their continued abuse and to have dragged or forced several victims to crawl into his bathroom where he partly drowned them in the bathtub before repeatedly reviving them, enabling him to continue his prolonged assault. He would generally murder his victims by placing a rope tourniquet around their neck before progressively tightening the rope with a hammer handle. He referred to this act as the rope trick.
Man, he has a lot of tricks up his sleeve.
Frequently informing his captive, this is the last trick. In at least one instance, he had read part of Psalm 23 as he tightened the rope around his victim's neck. What's Psalm 23?
I don't know.
Again, I didn't look anything up. I'm bad. Bad.
Let's see.
Psalm 23. Oh, it's the Lord is my shepherd.
Oh, of course it is.
Of course it is. Occasionally, the victim had convulsed for an hour or two before dying, although several victims died by asphyxiation from cloth gags stuffed deep into their throat. Except for his final two victims, all were murdered between 3 a.m. and 6 a.m.
Ah, the witching hour.
Ah, ha, ha. After death, Gacy usually stored the victim's bodies under his bed for about 24 hours before he buried his victim in the crawl space. He would pour quicklime on them to hasten the decomposition of his victims. Some victims' bodies were taken to his garage and embalmed prior to their burial. Because remember, he worked in a mortuary and watched the embalming process, so he knew how to do that.
So, the one of the first murders is Timothy McCoy. Gacy's first known murder occurred on January 3rd, 1972. According to Gacy's later account, following a family party on the evening of January 2nd, he decided to drive to the Civic Center in the Loop in Chicago to view a display of ice sculptures in the early hours of the following morning. He then lured 16-year-old Timothy Jack McCoy from Chicago's Greyhound bus terminal, big shocker, into his car. McCoy was traveling from Michigan to Omaha, Nebraska. Gacy took McCoy for a sightseeing tour of Chicago, then drove him to the house with a promise that he could spend the night and be driven back to the station in time to catch his bus. Prior to McCoy's identification, he was simply known as the Greyhound bus boy. Gacy claimed he woke up the following morning to find McCoy standing in his bedroom doorway with a kitchen knife in his hand. He then jumped from the bed. McCoy raised both arms in a gesture of surrender, tilting the knife upward and accidentally cutting Gacy's forearm. Gacy twisted the knife from McCoy's wrist and banged his head against the bedroom wall and kicked him against the wardrobe, walking towards him. McCoy then kicked Gacy in the stomach, doubling him over. Gacy then grabbed McCoy, shouting, "Motherfucker, I'll kill you." He then wrestled McCoy to the floor and stabbed him repeatedly in the chest as he straddled him. As McCoy lay dying, he claimed he washed the knife in the bathroom and then went to the kitchen to see an open carton of eggs and a slab of unsliced bacon on the kitchen table. McCoy had also set the table for two. He'd walk into Gacy's room to wake him while absentmindedly carrying the kitchen knife in his hand. DC buried McCoy in the crawl space and later covered the grave with a layer of concrete. In an interview several years after his arrest, Gacy said that that immediately after killing McCoy, he felt totally drained. You know, magically, he was totally drained again this time.
Yeah.
Rightfully so. Yet noted that as he stabbed McCoy and listened to the gurgulations and gasping for air, that he expressed a mind-numbing orgasm. He added, "That's when I realized that death was the ultimate thrill."
Which, how sad. Like, Timothy was just trying to make him breakfast in bed, and then he got fucking killed. Although I do guess that also, like, you know, maybe if you're going to make somebody breakfast in bed, like, don't walk into the bedroom carrying a knife in your hand.
There goes my Saturday, like, morning plans.
Right? I know. But, like, also, does anybody really buy slabs of unsliced bacon anymore? Probably. There's probably people that, like, go to butchers. But maybe sliced bacon's the way to go.
Yeah.
Just get, like, the good old Oscar Mayer pre-sliced shit.
Moral of the story. Sliced bacon.
Sliced bacon will save your life. Let's make a t-shirt.
We'll put a big picture of Pogo. Sliced bacon
only. Sliced bacon only, yes. All right. Now on to the second murder. Gacy said the second time he committed murder was January of 1974. All of this is Gacy's accounts, by the way. He did so many interviews.
Wait, and it wasn't from the victim's account?
Okay. It's not what I meant. You know that. I mean, it's not based on, like detective work or anything like that. Like, all of this is from, like, Gacy's own words. It's, like, him telling the story instead of, like, police found this guy on this day. You're a dick, by the way. So the second victim remains unidentified. Gacy strangled him, then placed the body in his closet before burial. He stated that the body fluids leaked from the victim's mouth and nose, staining his carpet. And as a result, Gacy regularly stuffed clothes rags, the victim's own underwear, or a sock into the mouths of subsequent victims to prevent the leakage from recurring.
Yum.
Gross. On July 31st, 1975, another of Gacy's employees, John Bukovich, an 18-year-old from Lombard, disappeared. Bukovich's car was found parked near the corner of Sheridan and Lawrence with his jacket and wallet inside, and the keys were still in the ignition. The day before his disappearance, he'd confronted Gacy over 2 weeks of outstanding back pay. Bukovich's father was a Yugoslav immigrant, and his father called Gacy, who claimed he was happy to help search for his son, but was sorry that he'd run away. When questioned by police, Gacy said that Bukovich and two friends had arrived at his house demanding the overdue pay. They'd reached a compromise and all three had left. Over the following 3 years, Bukovich's parents called police more than 100 times, urging them to investigate Gacy further. Gacy later admitted to encountering Bukovich exiting his car at the corner of West Lawrence Avenue, waving to attract his attention. He approached the car, saying, "I want to talk to you." Gacy invited Bukovich into his car, then invited him back to his home, ostensibly to settle the issue of the overdue wages. At his home, Gacy, following his MO, offered him a drink, then conned him into allowing his wrist to be cuffed behind his back. Gacy sat on his chest for a while and then strangled him. He stowed the body in the garage, intending to bury the body. I can't talk today. I'm really struggle busting. He stowed the body in the garage, intending to bury the body later in the crawl space. When wife and stepdaughters returned earlier than expected, Gacy buried the body under the concrete floor of the garage in an empty space where he had initially intended to dig a drain tile. So no drainage in the garage, just bodies.
Everyone needs more bodies. It's a foundation.
It's fertilizer.
Yeah. So in addition to being the year his business expanded, Gacy freely admitted that 1975 was also when he began to increase the frequency of excursions for sex with young males. He often referred to these jaunts as cruising. Gacy committed most of his murders between 1976 and 1978, and he largely lived alone following his divorce. He later referred to these as his cruising years. Although Gacy remained gregarious and civic-minded, several neighbors noticed erratic changes in the behavior after his 1976 divorce. This included seeing him with company of young males, hearing his car arrive or depart in the early hours of the morning, and seeing lights in his house switch on and off in early hours. One neighbor later recollected that for several years, the sound of muffled, high-pitched screaming, shouting, and crying had repeatedly awakened her and her son in the early morning hours. She identified the sounds as emanating from a house adjacent to theirs on Somerdale Avenue.
And so imagine being woken up by the cops.
Yeah. Imagine being woken up, you know, oh, it's nothing. It's nothing to find out there's 30
fucking serial killer living next door. Yeah. But also, like, I know there's that, what's the phenomenon where, like, you assume that other people have called the police and so you don't call the police, and in actuality, nobody called the police because they all did the same thing. I feel like that's probably what this is, was she was like, well, if it's anything bad, like, somebody's going to call somebody. But after, like, the first night when that happened and, like, no sirens came through, and then, like, the second time that happened and no sirens came through, like, why didn't you call?
Because that would have been too easy.
Fuck.
How dare we be responsible?
I tell ya.
Yeah. Where are we?
76.
Yes. So, 1 month after his divorce was finalized, Gacy abducted and murdered 18-year-old Daryl Sampson. He was last seen alive in Chicago on April 6, 1976, and Gacy buried him under the dining room with a section of cloth lodged in his throat, just like all the rest. 5 weeks later, on the afternoon of May 14th, 15-year-old Randall Reffitt disappeared while walking home from Senn High School. Hours after Gacy abducted Reffitt, 14-year-old Samuel Stapleton vanished as he was walking home from his sister's apartment. They were buried together in the crawl space, and investigators believe both victims were murdered on the same evening. So that's a busy day for him.
It's a busy day.
Yeah. On June 3rd, Gacy killed 17-year-old teenager named Michael Bonin. He disappeared while traveling from Chicago to Waukegan. Once again, Gacy strangled him with a ligature and buried him under the spare bedroom. 10 days later, Gacy murdered 16-year-old William Carroll and buried him in a common grave in the crawl space. I mean, I guess eventually you're just going to kind of run out of room and you're just going to just whatever the nearest hole is, just put him in there.
Right.
Carroll seems to have been one of the first of four victims to have been. Sorry, I misread that. Carroll seems to have been the first of four victims known to have been murdered between June 13th and August 6th of 1976. Three were between 16 and 17 years old, and one identified murder victim appeared to be an adult, which after, you know, when he was arrested, he was actually, he drew a map and said, you know, here, this is where all the bodies are, and every one of them was right where he said it.
Yep. That's so crazy.
Yeah.
I really wonder about the adult he killed. I feel like it must have been like a witness or somebody that like got in the way that he was just like, nope.
Yep.
Like, get rid of you. On August 5th, a 16-year-old named James Hackinson is last known to have phoned his family, possibly from Gacy's home. He died of suffocation, also buried in the crawl space. It was beneath the body of a 17-year-old Bensonville youth named Rick Johnston, who was last seen alive on August 6th. Gacy's thought to have murdered two further unidentified males between August and October of 76. On October 24th, he abducted and killed teenage friends Kenneth Parker and Michael Marino. The two were last seen outside a restaurant on Clark Street in Chicago. Which, Clark Street's a busy street. Like, I don't understand his ability. Like, I mean, it's a busy street now. But I don't understand his ability to just, like, snatch up two kids. But I guess he never just snatched. It was always conniving. And then 2 days later, a 19-year-old by the name of William Bundy disappeared after informing his family he was going to attend a party. Bundy also died of suffocation. He was buried beneath the master bedroom. Apparently, he worked for Gacy. And then December of 76, finishing out this, you know, real winter of a year, another employee, Gregory Godzik, disappeared. His girlfriend last saw him outside her house after he'd driven her home following a date. Godzik had worked for PDM for only 3 weeks before he disappeared. He informed his family that Gacy had him dig trenches for some kind of drain tiles in his crawl space, literally digging his own grave. The car was later found abandoned in Niles. His parents and older sister Eugenia contacted Gacy about Godzik's disappearance. Gacy claimed that he'd run away from home, obviously.
Yeah, having indicated
before that he had wished to do so. Gacy claimed to have received an answering machine message shortly after he disappeared. When asked if he could play back the message by Godzik's parents, Gacy, of course, said he'd erased it because the message didn't exist.
Yeah. So, another wonderful year, 1977. On January 20th, 1977, Gacy lured 19-year-old John...
Zick?
We'll go with Zick. To his house on the pretext of buying his Plymouth satellite. He later confessed to strangling Zick in the spare bedroom, claiming Rossi was asleep in the house the following morning. Gacy later sold the car to Rossi for $300. And this is kind of why Rossi was kind of seen as an accomplice.
I was going to say, further driving home that Rossi's an accomplice in all this.
Between December of 76 and March of 77, it is known Gacy killed another unidentified adult male and buried him in the crawl space underneath the body of the 20-year-old Michigan native named John Prestridge, who disappeared on March 15th. Shortly before his disappearance, Prestridge had mentioned that he obtained work with a local contractor. Once again, everything's pointing to Gacy, and it just never quite...
And nobody's seeing it. Like, how many of these boys are going missing that have just started working for him?
Yeah. Gacy murdered one additional unidentified youth and buried him in the crawl space in the spring or early summer of 77. The exact time of the murder has never been figured out. On July 5th, Gacy killed 19-year-old Matthew Bowman from Crystal Lake, Illinois. And Bowman's mother last saw him at a suburban train station. The following month, Rossi was arrested for stealing gasoline while driving John Sick's car. Kind of strange. The gas station attendant noted the license plate and the police traced the car to Gacy's house. When questioned, Gacy told officers that Sick had sold the car to him in February, saying he needed money to leave town. A check of the VIN confirmed that the car had belonged to Sick. And the police didn't pursue this any further, although they did inform that Sick's mother that the son had sold the car. So once again, he weasels his way out of it.
Once again, really all good roads, all roads lead to Gacy, but like nobody's going down them.
Nope. Those are creepy roads. We're just going to go the other way.
Right. Just ignore it.
So by the end of 1977, it is known Gacy had murdered six more young men between the ages of 16 and 21. The first of these victims was 18-year-old Robert Gilroy, who was actually the son of a Chicago police sergeant, and he was last seen alive on September 15th. Gilroy only lived four blocks from Gacy, and he was murdered and buried in the crawl space. On September 12th, Gacy had flown to Pittsburgh to supervise a remodeling project and did not return to Chicago until September 16th. Because Gacy is known to be in another state at the time of Gilroy's death, this is something else that supports that he had one or more accomplices in this. Once again, pointing Rossi. Because Rossi happened to live with Gacy, and magically this person was in Gacy's crawl space this time.
Right.
Yeah. So 10 days after Gilroy was last seen. Sorry, I lost my spot. Oh, there we go. 10 days after Gilroy was last seen, 19-year-old former U.S. Marine John Mowry disappeared after leaving his mother's house to walk to his apartment. Gacy strangled Mowry and buried his body beneath the master bedroom. He is way too busy of a man, let me tell you.
Right? Like, he's constantly killing. It's really, like, impressive.
You know, that's one thing, but being able to bury all these bodies is... That's no easy task. Yeah.
But I think also, again, big guy. These are relatively young men. Like,
and then, you know, Rossi helping him dig the holes.
And Rossi helping him. Well, also, he's hiring them to dig their own graves.
Yeah. I mean,
you know,
how much better does it get?
Right. Like, he has almost no physical labor in this.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look at him. I think he'd have a heart attack if he tried.
That's true.
So on October 17th, 21-year-old Russell Nelson disappeared. He was last seen outside a Chicago bar. Nelson was looking for contracting work. Big shocker. Gacy murdered him and buried him beneath the guest bedroom. Less than 4 weeks later, Gacy murdered a 16-year-old Kalamazoo teenager named Robert Winch and buried him in the crawl space. I'm just going to quit saying buried him in the crawl space. All these motherfuckers got buried in the crawl space.
Right. Almost, I mean, they were either in the crawl space, under the guest room, or other under the master bedroom. Yeah, like, they were under
all,
the house.
I mean, they're all, yeah.
They're under the house.
On November 18th, 20-year-old father of one, Tommy Bowling, disappeared after leaving a Chicago bar. 3 weeks after that murder, on December 9th, a 19-year-old David Telsma disappeared after informing his mother he was to attend a rock concert in Hammond. Gacy strangled Telsma with a ligature and buried him once again in the crawlspace next to John Mowry. I'm going to let you take over from here.
Okay.
I feel I've been rambling.
You're good. I mean, it's a never-ending list. It goes like, this is going to keep going.
I promise part two is a lot more interesting.
We have to get through all this. Like, I mean, it seems like a rambling list, but it just kind of gives you the size of this. So on December 30th of 77, Gacy abducted a 19-year-old Robert Donnelly from a Chicago bus stop at gunpoint. He drove him home, raped, tortured, and repeatedly dunked his head in a bathtub until he passed out. Gacy taunted him with statements such as, "Aren't we playing fun games tonight?" Donnelly survived. He actually later testified at Gacy's trial that he was in such pain that he asked Gacy to kill him. And Gacy replied, "I'm getting around to it." After several hours, Gacy drove Donnelly to his workplace and released him, warning him that if he complained to police, they wouldn't believe him. I want to understand why he didn't kill Donnelly, but like, it's never explained.
No. And I don't think he was the one that wrote the book.
Oh, okay.
It may have been, but I could be wrong.
In 1978, Donnelly reported the assault and police questioned Gacy on January 6, 78. Gacy admitted to having had a, quote, sex slave relationship with Donnelly, but insisted everything was consensual, adding that he, quote, didn't pay the kid the money he had promised him. The police believed him and filed no charges. Idiots.
Yeah.
Idiots. The following month, Gacy kept on killing because police think he can fucking do no wrong. He killed a 19-year-old William Kindred, who disappeared on February 16th after telling his fiance, who knew Gacy, that he was to spend the evening in a bar. Kindred was actually the final victim that Gacy was able to fit into the crawl space.
Hooray! So, we're finally done.
We're moving past the crawl space. Now we can go to new places because we actually move out of the home completely.
Yes.
So, March 21st, Gacy lures a 26-year-old Jeffrey Rignall into his car. Shortly after Rignall enters his car, we have a change in MO, everybody. We're now using chloroform. Gacy chloroformed him and drove him to his house, where his arms and head were restrained in a pillory device fixed to the ceiling and his feet locked into another device. Gacy explained to Rignall he had complete control over him and that he intended to do whatever he wanted, when he wanted, and how he wanted. So he raped and tortured him with various instruments, including lit candles and whips, and repeatedly chloroformed him into unconsciousness. Gacy then drove him to Lincoln Park in Chicago, not the band, the actual park, where he was dumped unconscious, but alive. Rignall managed to stagger to his girlfriend's apartment. Police were informed of the assault, but did not investigate Gacy.
Also, Rignall was the one who wrote the book.
Are you sure this time?
Yes. Positive. Okay. I looked it up here.
Okay.
Good luck finding a copy of it. Jeffrey Rignall
wrote a book, everybody.
And he's also dead now.
Oh, that's sad.
Yeah. He died in 2000, I believe it said.
Oh, okay. So he lived a good life.
Well, 49.
Oh, he was young.
Yeah, let's see. Died of AIDS-related causes.
Oh, that's sad. So, I wonder if he got it from Gacy. That's a weird concept to think about.
I will have to talk to Helen and see if she knew if he had anything.
Yeah, can we test? We can surely test one of. Well, I know his stuff's been on alcohol for forever. Anyway.
Yeah, I'll just ask her. She'll know.
She'll know. Rignall managed to stagger to his girlfriend's apartment. Police were informed to not investigate. Ugh. He was able to recall through the haze of that night, the Oldsmobile, the Kennedy Expressway, and particular side streets. He and two friends staked out the Cumberland exit of the expressway. And in April, he saw the Oldsmobile, which he and his friends followed to 8213 West Summerdale. Police obtained an arrest warrant and Gacy was arrested on July 15th. He faced trial for battery. So I guess it's more because they didn't investigate because he wasn't sure where, who it was. Yeah. I guess. I don't know. None of this makes sense. This entire fucking thing doesn't make sense.
It really was a perfect storm.
Just of stupidity.
Yeah.
So, like we said, by 78, the crawl space was out of room. Gacy later confessed to police that he considered stowing bodies in his attic, but had been worried about complications arising from that leakage that he loved so much. So he chose to start disposing of victims off the I-55 bridge into the Des Plaines River. He stated he had thrown 5 bodies into a river in 1978. He believed one had landed on a passing barge. and 4 others were never found. The first known thrown from the I-55 bridge into the Des Plaines River was 20-year-old Timothy O'Rourke. He was murdered in mid-June after leaving his Dover Street apartment to purchase cigarettes. Shortly before his disappearance, O'Rourke had told his roommate a contractor on the northwest side had offered him a job. Oh, Rhodes. Casey. So,
I'm going to steal this next one because...
Go for it.
So on November 4th, Gacy killed 19-year-old Frank Landingen, and his naked body was found in the Des Plaines River in Shanahan, Illinois on November 12th. I actually have a former coworker who was actually on the force that found that body. And Shanahan's only, what, 15 minutes from me, 20 minutes from me?
From you? Yeah, that's crazy.
I've actually kayaked around where that was. So... kind of just a cool little tidbit.
You're so sad you haven't found a body yet.
No, I do not want to. I deal with dead bodies every day at work. I don't need any more.
But a dead body in the river is different.
No, because that's a lot of paperwork, and that's then I got to stick around.
And it ruins your kayaking day. Yeah, that's true.
That's just too much work. Dealing with them at work is more than enough. On November 24th, 20-year-old Elmwood Park resident James Mazura disappeared after sharing Thanksgiving dinner with his family. Mazura had informed his sister the day prior to his disappearance that he was working in the construction industry and doing all right. He was last seen alive, walking in the direction of Bughouse Square, which is the bus station, carrying a suitcase. Now we move on to the murder of Robert Peast. On the afternoon of December 11th, 1978, Gacy visited the Nissan pharmacy in Des Plaines to discuss a potential remodeling deal with the store owner, Phil Torf. While he was within earshot of the 15-year-old part-time employee, Robert, Gacy mentioned that his firm also hired teenage boys at a starting wage of $5 an hour, which that's a lot more than what Peace was making because Peace was working at the pharmacy making roughly half that. Shortly after Gacy left the pharmacy, Peace's mother arrived at the store to drive her son home so the family could celebrate her birthday together. Peace asked his mother to wait, adding that some contractor wanted to talk to me about a job. He left the store at 9 p.m., promising to return shortly. Peace was murdered shortly after 10 o'clock at Gacy's house. Gacy later stated that at his house, he asked Peace whether there was anything he wouldn't do for the right price, to which Peace replied that he did not mind working hard. In response, Gacy stated, good money could be earned by hustling. Although Peace was dismissive, Gacy then duped Peace into donning the handcuffs before saying, I'm going to rape you and you can't do anything about it. And Peace began weeping. He also stated that he had placed a rope around Peace's neck and the boy was crying scared. Gacy admitted to having received a phone call from a business acquaintance as Peace lay dying, suffocating on the bedroom floor.
Ugh.
Yeah.
So sickening.
Oh, good old Gacy.
Ugh. So Peace obviously failed to return, and so his family filed a missing person report with the Des Plaines police. Torf named Gacy as the contractor Peace had most likely left the store to talk about a job, and Lieutenant Joseph Kozenzak?
Yes.
Yeah. Whose son attended Maine West High School like Peace, chose to investigate Gacy further. Finally, somebody's investigating Gacy.
About goddamn time.
Fuck. Having spoken with Peace's mother on the morning of December 12th, Kozenzak became convinced Peace had not run away from home. A routine check of Gacy's criminal background revealed that he had an outstanding battery charge against him in Chicago and had served a prison sentence in Iowa for the sodomy of a 15-year-old boy. Weird. It's almost like if you just do a quick background check.
Yeah.
You but see yet he could
yet he passed a Secret Service background check.
Right? Kozenzak and two Des Plaines police officers visited Gacy at his home the following evening. Gacy indicated he had seen two youths working at the pharmacy and that he had asked one of them, who he maybe thought was Peace, whether there were any remodeling materials behind the store. He was adamant, however, that he had not offered Peace a job and had only returned to the pharmacy shortly after 8 p.m. as he had left his appointment book at the store. He promised to come to the station later that evening to make a statement confirming this, indicating he was unable to do so at the moment as his uncle had just died. When questioned as to how soon he could come to the police station, he responded, "You guys are very rude. Don't you have any respect for the dead?"
How fitting.
I tell ya. So of course he shows up at 3:20 a.m. to the police station, covered in mud, claiming that he'd been involved in a car accident. On returning to the police station later that day, Gacy denied any involvement in the disappearance of Peace, obviously, repeated he had not offered him a job, obviously, and when asked why he had returned to the pharmacy, Gacy reiterated that he had done so in response to a phone call from Torf informing him he had left his appointment book at the store. Detectives had already spoken with Torf, however, and he had denied calling Gacy. At the request of detectives, Gacy prepared a written statement detailing his movements on December 11th. So obviously they're looking for holes, but he's kind of too good to like have.
He was always a step ahead.
He was always a step ahead, but he was also really good at maintaining his consistencies, like his lies. Like he got his lie and he stuck to it. There were never inconsistencies in his story. This was his story. And he was really phenomenally good at sticking to it.
Yeah. So, suspecting that Gacy may be holding Peace against his will at his home, Des Plaines police obtained a warrant to search Gacy's house on December 13th.
December 13th?
13th, yeah. It's been a long day.
Yeah, it has.
The search of Gacy's property revealed several suspicious items, including several police badges, a 6mm Brevetta starting pistol inside an office drawer, a syringe and hypodermic needle inside a cabinet in Gacy's bathroom, which really isn't that suspicious. I mean, it's a bathroom, it's a cabinet. Investigators also found handcuffs, books on homosexuality and pederasty.
I'm not sure what that one is. Hold on.
Seven pornographic films, capsules of amyl nitrate, and a 18-inch or 46-centimeter dildo in Gacy's bedroom.
Pederasty is sexual activity involving a man and a boy.
That fits him.
So it's specific pedophilia, essentially.
Yeah. A 39-inch 2x4 with two holes drilled in each end, bottles of Valium, atropine, and several driver's licenses were found in the northwest bedroom. A blue hooded parka was found atop a toolbox inside the laundry room, and underwear too small to fit Gacy was located in a bathroom closet. In the northwestern bedroom, investigators also found a class of 1975 Maine West High School ring engraved with the initials JAS. Investigators also recovered a Nissan pharmacy photo receipt from a trash can along a 36-inch section of nylon rope. So they found a little treasure trove of stuff here.
They found so much stuff. And like, I don't know. No, it's not enough to convict, but man, it's enough that like, I feel like we should be doing a more thorough search of the house, but you know, what do I know?
Maybe the crawl space.
Crawl space. Maybe. Also, spoiler, the smell is what gets him later when he's an arrogant fucking prick and invites him into his home. Why is there no smell at this point? Like, is it? Do you want to know why? It's because it's winter.
Yeah.
It's fucking winter.
And this
time.
May have been after he started pouring concrete down there.
Yeah, but still, they still got him by the smell.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's December 13th. It's winter in Chicago. They're frozen. That's why there's no smell. All right, that makes sense now.
So if you're going to hide the bodies in the crawl space, do it in the winter.
Yes.
The look on your face was priceless.
Or don't hide bodies in your crawl space.
Where else am I supposed to hide them? The river's frozen in December.
So the Des Plaines police confiscated Gacy's Oldsmobile and the other PDM work vehicles. Police assigned two-man surveillance teams to monitor Gacy on a rotational 12-hour basis as they continued their investigation into his background and potential involvement in Peace's disappearance. These surveillance teams consisted of Mike Albrecht and David Hochmeister and Ronald Robinson and Robert Schultz. The following day, investigators received a phone call from Michael Rossi, who informed the investigators of Gregory Godzik's disappearance and the fact that another PDM employee, Charles Hatula, had been found drowned in an Illinois river earlier that year.
It's magical that he knew about him. Yeah, I can't imagine why.
Kind of shout out to Rossi for like calling it in. And I think that's probably how he was able to like plea out of shit, but whatever.
Yeah, he had a hand in it.
He did.
He had to.
On December 15th, Des Plaines investigators obtained further details of Gacy's battery charge, learning the complainant, Jeffrey Rignall, had reported that Gacy had lured him into his car, then chloroformed, raped, and tortured him before dumping him with severe chest and facial burns and rectal bleeding in Lincoln Park the following morning. In an interview with Gacy's former wife the same day, they learned of the disappearance of John Bukovich. The same day, the Maine West High School ring was traced to John Allen Sizek. Sizek? What did we say? Zick?
Sick.
I don't know. An interview with Sick's mother revealed that several items from her son's apartment were also missing, including a Motorola TV set. By December 16th, Gacy was becoming affable with the surveillance detectives, regularly inviting them to join him for meals in restaurants and occasionally for drinks in bars or at his home.
Which really had to piss them off. Imagine this guy you're trying to nail for this. Multiple homicides,
right?
Hey, come in and eat with me.
All it makes me think of is Beverly Hills Cop when he's like, when they're doing the surveillance outside the hotel and he's sending them room service. Like, that's all this would make me think of. He obviously repeatedly denied that he had anything to do with Peace's disappearance, accused the officers of harassing him because of his political connections or because of his recreational drug use. Knowing these officers were unlikely to arrest him on anything trivial, he taunted them by flouting traffic laws and succeeded in losing his pursuers more than once. That afternoon, Cram consented to a police interview in which he described Gacy's hardworking lifestyle and open-minded attitude regarding sex between men. Cram also revealed that because of his poor timekeeping, Gacy had once given him a watch, explaining he got it, quote, from a dead person.
You don't fucking say.
And then he wore it. He wore the watch. Even if it was a joke, don't joke that you're giving me something from a dead person.
Hey, I'm going to mail you shit from a dead person.
Well, okay, but that's different. That's different.
Also, it's okay if it's from me.
Well, yeah. I don't know. Not off like a... Like, don't get it out of, like, the dead box in the hospital. I don't want that.
Now you're just fucking picky.
Or the butt box. You guys have a butt box in the ER?
I cannot confirm nor deny it.
Every hospital has a butt box, everybody. And it's all the stuff that we pull out of people's butts.
Which is surprisingly a lot of shit.
Mason jars, shampoo bottles, Barbie dolls.
Yeah, toy cars, you name it. It's been up there.
I slipped and fell on it.
Yeah, sure you did. Sure. The 6-inch diameter candle clearly just went right up
there. Right up there.
No stretching, no tearing, no. Just boop. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, just boop, right up. Yeah, the lubricant just happened to be there. Yep.
Investigators conducted a formal interview of Rossi on December 17th. He informed them that Gacy had sold 6 vehicle to him, explaining that he'd bought the car from him because he needed money to move to California. A further examination of Gacy's Oldsmobile was conducted on this date. And in the course of examining the trunk of the car, investigators discovered a small cluster of fibers that may have been human hair. That evening, officers conducted a test using three trained German Shepherd search dogs to determine whether Peace had been present in any of Gacy's vehicles. One dog approached Gacy's automobile, laid on the passenger seat, and what the dog handler informed investigators was a death reaction, indicating Peace's body had been present in the vehicle.
That such a evening, good doggy.
Yeah. That evening, Gacy invited detectives Albrecht and Hochmeister into a restaurant for a meal. And in the early hours of December 18th, he invited them into another restaurant where over breakfast, he talked of his business, his marriages, and his activities as a registered clown. At one point during the conversation, Gacy remarked, you know, clowns can get away with murder.
So fucked.
Yeah, he taunted them so much and they couldn't do anything.
Well, and that's the thing is he was right. Like with the traffic violations and stuff like that, like they're trying to take this guy down for being a serial killer. Because at this point, they're pretty positive he has at least like 4 or 5 victims. But so they like he can fuck with them because they're not going to take him down for anything less than that.
Yep. So by December 18th of this year, Gacy was beginning to show signs of strain from the constant surveillance. He was unshaven, looked tired, appeared anxious, and was drinking heavily. That afternoon, he drove to his lawyer's office to prepare a $750,000 civil suit against the Des Plaines police, demanding that they cease their surveillance. The same day, the serial number of Nissan Pharmacy photo receipt found in Gacy's kitchen was traced to 17-year-old Kim Byers, a colleague of Peace at Nissan Pharmacy. Byers admitted when contacted in person the following day that she had worn the jacket on December 11th to shield herself from the cold. She'd placed the receipt in the parka pocket just before she gave the coat to Peace as he left the store, claiming a contractor wanted to speak with him. This statement contradicted Gacy's previous statements that he had no contact with Robert Peace on the evening of December 11th. So, big shocker, Gacy fucking lied again.
He lied, yeah. And while he was consistent, there's still inconsistencies.
Yeah.
So that same evening, so this is December 18th. Yep. Rossi was interviewed a second time. This time he was more cooperative than he'd been the first time. And he informed detectives that in the summer of 77, he had spread 10 bags of lime in the crawl space at Gacy's house. On the 19th, investigators began compiling enough evidence for a second search warrant for the house. That same day, Gacy's lawyers filed the civil suit against the police department. The hearing for the suit was scheduled for December 22nd. That afternoon, Gacy invited the surveillance detectives inside his house again. As Officer Robinson distracted Gacy with conversation, Officer Schultz walked into Gacy's bedroom in an unsuccessful attempt to write down the serial number of the Motorola TV because they suspected that it had been the one that belonged to John Sick. While flushing Gacy's toilet, however, the officer noticed a smell he suspected could be that of rotting corpses emanating from a heating duct. The officers who had searched Gacy's house previously had failed to notice this as the house had been cold. Ha ha, we were right. We just hadn't moved far enough through it. Look at that. Shouldn't have turned the heat on, my guy. Blankets work real well. Investigators interviewed both Cram and Rossi on December 20th. Rossi had agreed to be interviewed in relation to his possible links with John Sick, as well as the disappearance of Robert Peace. When questioned by Cousin Zach as to where he believed Gacy had concealed Peace's body, Rossi replied Gacy may have placed the body in the crawl space, adding that he thought Sick's car was stolen. Rossi agreed to submit to a polygraph test. He denied any involvement in Peace's disappearance, also denying any knowledge of his whereabouts. He soon refused to continue the questioning, and Rossi's erratic and inconsistent responses to questions while attached to the polygraph machine rendered them unable to definitively determine whether or not he was telling the truth. So he wasn't. He was lying. He's involved.
Yeah.
Rossi did, however, further discuss the trench digging he did in the crawl space and remarked on Gacy's insistence that he not deviate from where he was instructed to dig. Obviously, so he didn't disturb the bodies that were down there. Cram informed investigators of Gacy's attempts to rape him in 1976 and stated that he and Gacy had returned home. After the December 13th search of his property, Gacy turned pale after seeing a clot of mud on his carpet, which he suspected had come from the crawl space. Cram said Gacy grabbed a flashlight and immediately entered the crawl space to look for evidence of digging. When asked whether he had been to the crawl space, Cram replied he had once been asked by Gacy to spread lime down there and had also dug trenches, which Gacy had explained were drainage pipes. These trenches were 2 feet wide, 6 feet long, and 2 feet deep, which is a good size for graves.
Yeah. So, on the evening of December 20th, Gacy drove to his lawyer's office in Park Ridge to attend a scheduled meeting to discuss the progress of a civil suit. Upon his arrival, Gacy appeared disheveled and immediately asked for an alcoholic drink, whereas Sam Amirante fetched a bottle of whiskey from his car. On his return, Amirante asked Gacy what he wanted to discuss with them. Gacy picked up a copy of the Daily Herald from Amirante's desk, and he pointed to a front page article covering the disappearance of Robert Peace and said, "This boy is dead. He's dead. He's in a river." Gacy then proceeded to give a rambling confession that ran the early hours of the following morning. He began by informing Amirante and Stevens he had been the judge, jury, and executioner of many, many people, and that now he wanted to be the same for himself. He said he buried most of the victims in his crawl space and had disposed of five others in the Des Plaines River. Gacy dismissed his victims as male prostitutes, hustlers, and liars, to whom he gave the rope trick, adding he sometimes awoke to find the dead, strangled kids on the floor, with their hands cuffed behind their back. He had buried the bodies in the crawl space as he believed they were his property. As a result of the alcohol he had consumed, Gacy fell asleep midway through his confession. Amirante immediately arranged a psychiatric appointment for Gacy at 9 o'clock that morning. Upon waking several hours later, Gacy shook his head when informed by Amirante that he had confessed to killing approximately 30 people, saying, "Well, I can't think about this right now. I've got things to do." Ignoring his lawyer's advice regarding his scheduled appointment, Gacy left their office to attend to the needs of his business.
Sure. I mean, what a solid businessman.
Yeah. Do you want to go or you want me to go?
We both looked up at each other like, who's going? I can go.
All right.
Gacy later recollected his memories of his final day of freedom as being hazy because he's hungover, adding he knew his arrest was inevitable and that he intended to visit his friends and say his final farewells. After leaving his lawyer's office, Gacy drove to a gas station where, in the course of filling his rental car, he handed a small bag of cannabis to the attendant, who immediately handed the bag to the surveillance officers, adding that Gacy had told him, "The end is coming for me. These guys are going to kill me." Also, shout out to the attendant who was smart enough to turn in the drugs and not get arrested for having weed.
However, that would have been an awesome story for the rest of his life.
Oh, my God.
How'd you get arrested? No. Ah, Gacy gave me weed.
Gacy gave me weed, and I didn't do anything about it, and there were cops watching him.
Yeah.
Gacy drove to the home of a fellow contractor and friend, Ronald Rode. He hugged Rode before bursting into tears and saying, quote, "I've been a bad boy. I killed 30 people, give or take a few." Gacy left Rode and drove to Cram's house to meet with Cram and Rossi. As he drove along the expressway, the surveillance officers noted he was holding a rosary to his chin and was praying while he drove. After talking with Cram and Rossi, Gacy had Cram drive him to a scheduled meeting with lawyer Leroy Stevens. As Gacy spoke with him, Cram informed the surveillance officers that Gacy had told him and Rossi that he had confessed to all these murders with his lawyer the previous evening. Gacy then had Cram drive him to Maryhill Cemetery, where his father was buried. As Gacy drove to various locations that morning, police outlined the formal draft of their second search warrant, specifically to search for the body of Robert Peace in the crawl space. On hearing from the surveillance detectives that in light of his erratic behavior, Gacy may be about to commit suicide, police went ahead and arrested him on a charge of possession and distribution of cannabis, which was really just to hold him in custody.
Which is very smart on their part.
Very, very smart, because I do think Gacy probably would have killed himself.
Yeah.
At 4:30 on December 21st, the eve of the hearing of Gacy's civil suit, Judge Marvin J. Peters granted the request for a second search warrant. After police informed Gacy of their intention to search his crawl space for the body of Peace, Gacy denied the teenager was buried there, but confessed to having killed a young man in self-defense and whose body was buried under the garage.
So now that they have a second search warrant, police and evidence technicians drove to Gacy's house at 8213. On their arrival, officers had found Gacy had unplugged the sump pump, flooding the crawl space with water. To clear it, they simply just replaced the plug, and waited for the water to drain. After it done so, evidence technician Daniel Gentry entered the 28 by 38 foot crawl space, crawled to the southwest area, and began digging. Within minutes, he had uncovered putrefied flesh and human arm bone. Gentry immediately shouted to the investigators that they could charge Gacy with murder, adding, "I think this place is full of kids." A police photographer then dug in the northeast corner of the crawl space, uncovering a patella. The two then began digging in the southeast corner, uncovering two lower leg bones. The victims were too decomposed to be pieced, and as the second body was discovered in the northeast corner, was later unearthed, a crime scene technician discovered the skull of a second victim alongside the body. Later excavations of the feet of this at the feet. I cannot read.
Neither can I. It's all good.
Later excavations of the feet of the second victim revealed a further skull beneath this body. Because of this, technicians returned to the trench where the first body was unearthed, discovering the rib cage of a fourth victim within the crawl space, confirming the scale of the murders.
So.
Yeah, so this is kind of
it
starts going down.
Oh,
and it's going to be a perfect place for us to end part one, kind of leave you guys hanging that you know that they have him, they have bodies. Obviously, I mean, they put him to death. However, we'll get more into that next time.
But there's way more to come, actually.
Oh, yeah.
It's not a quick arrest trial put to death. There's some loops and twists and turns ahead.
Yeah.
So on that note, we're going to end it here. We'll see you guys next week for part two of John Wayne Gacy.
See everyone next week.